Hey, Pat.
Hey, Max.
Well, we are here alive at NerdCon Stories. Thanks for coming, everyone. This is a lot of people.
This is kind of a lot of people.
Bullshit.
A lot of people who actually have no idea what they're in for. There's a few people that have listened to the podcast before, and a lot of people who, I think, were just cold. It's cold outside.
Yeah, this will be the first and last time that they listen to the podcast, I think. I feel like we got to get the election stuff out of our system, but we've asked the audience to enforce a strict 10-minute bummer talk ban on us lamenting Donald Trump.
Yeah, so now I think here's the problem is it's not like we have a chess clock here that as soon as the politic talk starts, we can hit the chess clock so we can accurately quantify 10 minutes. So I think that might go off the rails in terms of reining us in. I think we need something more easily quantifiable. How about together, between the two of us, we cannot make more than 5 political statements.
We're never going to follow this rules. Have you met me?
Okay, then between the two of us, we should. Yeah, I don't want to do that.
This is like how we wake up every morning and we're like, today I'm not going to run more than 10 minutes late for anything. And then I'm 3 hours late to lunch and...
That's, yeah. You know what I did? I actually, well, see, the problem is setting the time limit. I actually started a Skype call a couple of nights ago, and somebody just said, oh, what's, you know, the equivalent of like, so how you doing? And I'm like, well, okay, real quick. And I talked for an hour. I go, I'll do the short version. And then I just, it was just like, I did not even breathe. It was just like a foghorn blaring out. Like, just a big story hash. And at the end, I'm like, I am so sorry. So, okay. And besides, we can't share these, right? We can't share. If we do 5, then you'll use up all 5, and then I'll have nothing.
No.
So, we each, 3. 3's the magic number, Max.
If you make a game, we're both going to cheat.
Nope. We can't, because they're watching us.
All right. They're gonna start the Mighty Ducks slow clap?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Also, here's the thing. We have to set a consequence.
Okay.
Like, we used to set consequences. What happens if we go over our 3?
The podcast will be sad and everyone will stop listening.
Max, obviously that isn't enough to rein us in. We've already... okay, how about this? If for every 1 we go over 3, and the audience will keep track, okay, then we are going to have to donate $25 to Donald Trump's campaign.
I won't agree to those... I won't agree to those terms. I won't agree to those terms.
It'll keep us honest, I'm saying. Like, there's no way we will violate that.
No. I won't agree to those terms. We give money to Paul Ryan.
I can't.
He's,
feel
hey,
good.
Lesser of two evils. Lesser of two evils.
The thing is, it has to be a real
right,
negative.
I'm going to use 1 of my 5 Donald Trump statements. And I just
it's 3. See, he's trying to game the system.
It's 3?
Only 3 political... commentary sections. It doesn't have to be a single statement.
That's an hour of the podcast. All right. I'm using my first one. I just fuck that guy so much. I fucking. The amount of mental energy I'm expending every single day, including at this very positive, nice, wonderful convention, obsessing, sleeplessly turning it over in my head and trying to get inside that guy's head and I'm devouring, just eating all the crumbs of the news that fall out of him. I cannot fucking take this. It's every day. I'm always like, well, this is it. We've bottomed out. I'm like, this is it. Like, it's got, at least we've seen it. And today, it's like, I don't even want to repeat any of the things he said today. It's fucking crazy if you guys haven't been reading the news. It's a new low. Every day is a new low. But of, like, democracy. Of, like, society.
Not just politics.
No, it's great. Like, I'm honestly very concerned about, like, does this toothpaste go back in the tube after the election?
Oh, like, can society recover as a whole?
Yeah, because that's a thing of, like, that's like how power works in the real life. Like, people like to imagine that it's like, well, the rules of the game say that you have to follow these laws and the Constitution works a certain way and there's a chain of command and et cetera, et cetera. But in the real, like you know, corrupt, bloody arena of power and politics and life, like, rules only exist by social convention. They exist because of decency, because, like, good people say agree to follow the rules. And we're so past the rules of decency. Like, this guy has no... When he goes on stage and says, the election's rigged and you people need to go out to certain areas and make sure that the voting is on the up and up because it's going to be stolen.
He
has no regard for the democratic institution. It's like...
Okay, so I'm going to use one of mine, right? Can we agree that that was one statement? Okay. I'm going to use one of mine. I'm going to leapfrog off of that and say... Oh, shit, I forgot what I was going to say. That doesn't count if I forget. That doesn't count. You were talking about how he was doing the thing. And, no, I forgot it.
All right.
I forgot it. It'll come back.
All right, it's out of my system. It's out of my system for the moment.
That's good. And, like, we kind of... It's important to have, like, this cathartic moment, you know, because you got to get it off your chest somehow. So I will... Actually, I'll use the second one of mine. I'm saving that first one for when that comes back to sort of tell a more of a lighthearted, you know, politics story that kind of underscores, I think, how a lot of us have been impacted by the election. I was talking with an author, and we were just hanging out and having dinner, and he said, "Yeah, I turned in my book," and he looks at me, like, no. And what he was doing, he was actually commiserating, and he goes, 2 months late, and I'm like, "Yeah, 2 months late, woo!" You know, because it's healthy for him to realize you can break a deadline, you know, and I'm the patron saint of that, and. And he goes, you know, and I talked to my publisher, and he is clockwork. You know, he gets the fucking job done, you know? And which, like, of course, just delights me, because him missing a deadline by 2 months is like me missing one by 20 years. And he goes in and he says, you know, "Hey, you know, guys," he's talking to the publisher, "I'm sorry. I know, you know, this isn't like me." And they're like, "Matt," and what he said is, "It's the election. It's like in my head. I can't stop. I can't not care. I can't not participate. I can't not talk. I can't not try to, like, spread information and help maybe elevate the discourse or contribute to the discussion in a helpful way." He's like, "But it's just all the time on me." And what the publisher said is, "Everyone's book is late because of the election." And they weren't funning around. They're like, "The entire spring lineup has been getting turned in late." And this, so there's my number two, right? So I'm going to, but this ties into something that I've mentioned before. I can't remember if I've talked about it here on the podcast, which is, I don't believe in writer's block. I don't think it exists. Have I done that spiel here?
No, let's go.
Should we have it?
Let's have it.
Okay. Can we do a musical sting?
Yeah, here we go.
You know, because...
New segment.
Because you've been... You know, I don't listen to the Finnish podcast because I have a trouble listening to the sound of my own voice. Although if it always sounded like it did over this mic, I would just never stop talking. Even more than I normally am already never stopping talking. But it occurs to me that there are people out there that hear my voice and you feed in these cues. They're being like Pavlovian trained. It's like, you hear this noise, it's like, now Pat's gonna just fucking ramble on for a while. And it makes me want to get it on a keychain. So, like, I can just walk around and maybe just, like, push the button and see who goes. You know, and then I hadn't thought any farther than that, actually. That's my whole plan. That's the entirety of my plan. Oh, I just laughed so hard I gave myself a head rush.
All right, I'm going to use another one of my election things. There's like a Twitter hot take also that's really upsetting me. And honestly, I need everyone to stop doing this. Where everyone have you guys seen the hot take of the election where people are like, well, Trump, everyone sucks. Like Trump and Hillary both suck. But it's like we have to hold our nose and vote for Hillary to like stop Trump. And it's like I can't believe we have to vote for Hillary. Like that is like one of the all time like dumbest historical perspective viewpoints that you could hold. Like Hillary is. She is one of the best political candidates to run for office for president in our lifetime. By like name a metric, I know people have bad feelings about her, but like name a metric on paper and how she is like the most prepared, most qualified, most connected, best deal maker. Like who? There is like nobody. Like Obama, I wouldn't want Obama to go back in and like repair the damage of this election. Like Hillary's the person to go make deals and get it done. The smallest things set people off. Where Hillary says like, and she goes like, "I just hope we can get these kids to Pokemon Go to the polls." And then on the other hand, Trump is like, "Hey, you know, Hitler had some good ideas. We should really be rounding people up." and everyone's like, "Well, there's like a lot of good ideas and bad ideas on both sides. We really got to think this through." Like,
you know, and I will admit because I was Bernie early on, and you know. And there's a lot. Bernie had a certain charisma that is kind of essential these days, or rather, it's very helpful in modern elections because everybody is all over everywhere. And also, Bernie had like a very compelling, simple narrative, which is like Bernie's been in it to win it. Bernie's been doing this. He's been in there fighting for a long time, and. And then I read a really interesting article that said, you know, Bernie's been proposing this legislation every year for the last 30 years. And at first I'm like, yeah, you stick it to the man, Bernie, although you are a man also. You are part of the man, the collective man. And then this person wrote an article and said, you know, somebody who keeps doing the same thing again and again, knowing that it's not going to come to anything, isn't actually getting something done, that's being a poser. That's one of the elements of insanity. You know, it's like, or maybe it is you're just if you never change your legislation, you never try to go out and round people up and say, hey guys, we really have to get this through this year. And instead, you propose legislation and then knowing it's going to get voted down, what have you accomplished other than you're like, well, I did my part, but you didn't. Like nothing has changed. Maybe all you get is you feel good about yourself. And that it. And now this article talked about it in more depth and really kind of in a richer and honestly a more gentle way than what I just said. But it started me thinking that you know, I don't admire that. Once I look at it and think about it, that's a very compelling narrative that he's in there. He's always been fighting for this. He's sort of pure. He's this idealist. And I do love the thought of like this pure idealist thing. But honestly, it's like if I'm going to have somebody in there like fighting, it's like I want somebody who like can make a deal.
Yeah, I had a...
By the way, that was me commenting on his. That wasn't one of mine.
That was no. I'm using my final one.
Max, we got a lot of podcasts left. Is all I'm saying.
I know we got to eventually. We got to talk about something other than this fucking election, though.
Yeah, but if you use your last one, you're just gonna. I know what's gonna happen. You'll use your last one. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about something else for a while. Mm-hmm. It'll come back. And
the system is rigged, Pat. It's rigged. All right. I had a third one. I just wanted to. I mean, I just what you're talking about. I had like an epiphany in this election, and it was I went to the DNC, and I had been sort of on the fence. I didn't really take a strong side on Hillary versus Bernie. Like neither of them, you know, kind of did it for me in the same way as Obama did. And I eventually got very excited about Hillary at the convention. But I had this like epiphany that was about my own attitudes towards this election, and it was at the at the DNC, there was one state who the woman who like cast the nominating vote for Hillary was born before women had the right to vote. They were born before women had the franchise, and it was a moment for me of seeing that woman in real life. This, you know, old woman who this entire participation of women in politics at this level happened within a single person's lifetime, which is crazy to me. It gave me this moment of reflection of like how new it is for women to be in this arena, and how much of politics as like the American tradition elevates these things that men are really good at, like giving people, like being the alpha male in the debate and like dominating everyone with body language, which is a thing that CNN has commentators analyzing the body language to see whether Hillary or Trump was the alpha dog, right? And they're like, Trump, very aggressive posture, he looked great. The dumbest of all possible takes. But it's like...
I think it's a valid comment, but it's like, I do not want a fucking gorilla running my country.
But Americans do. But that's how we do it typically, right? Or like firing the audience up with a big speech or whatever. And those are not Hillary's strong suits. But you know, looking at the convention, it was interesting because the way here's how Hillary won the nomination. Before anyone else had a chance to announce, she locked up all of the major Democratic donors. She locked up all of the congressional endorsements. She locked up all of the gubernatorial endorsements. She locked up all of the Senate endorsements. She locked up all of the newspaper endorsements. She hired all the staff. I have a friend who runs an apparel company, and sometimes they do work for political campaigns. Very early on, the Clinton campaign contacted them and was like, hey, we'd like a contract where you exclusively will make apparel for us and we'll pay you for it. They signed the contract, and then they never hired that company to make apparel, but the idea was neither could anyone else, right?
Yeah.
Hillary locked it up.
Yep.
So, but she sucked all the air out of the room, and she used the powers of negotiation and deal making to sew up the nomination. And you know, at the end of the day, there she was standing on the stage. She won, right?
Right.
She won, and she did it in a way that, as far as I know, it's never really been done before.
Well, and it actually demonstrates the skills required to get shit done in politics.
That's exactly it. But all along, me, and I saw definitely many of the Bernie people and now the Trump people, they look at that, and it was only ever used as further evidence of her corruption and her dishonesty. And I honestly was this plus the issue of how new women are in politics and how much we privilege the things that like men are traditionally, you know, better at and this kind of thing. And I was like, man, this is a sexist system. And I saw something in myself of like the way that I viewed these things as somehow evidence of Hillary's unsavory corruption. And I was like, I was surprised to find that in myself.
Yeah. And the truth is there's being actively sexist or racist. And then there's sort of being almost like reflecting what we have slowly absorbed through the culture. You know, and one we are responsible for, and we owe it in ourselves to like really get that shit under wraps. You know, like if you are actively participating in these things, willfully or maliciously doing these things, just inexcusable. And the other you are also responsible for, but it's really tricky. It's like super, super tricky. And I won't say that it's forgivable, but I will say that it's more forgivable. And it's easier if you kind of acknowledge that we all do it. You know, it's not like, oh, one of us, or it's super bad. It's just sort of part of being human and living in a culture means... I mean, just to throw out an example, is something I feel bad. Somebody made a joke about me using British slang in my books. And I do. I've used a few pieces of British slang because I used to watch Red Dwarf, right? And so... like I've absorbed those pieces of slang really organically, not even coming from that culture, but my culture brushed up against that culture. And one of them, I think, was... I think it was Bosch, which is... It might just be a nonsense word, whatever. The other is, at some point in the books, Bast calls somebody a silly little bint. And somebody's like, oh, shit, Rothfuss, you know? And the thing is, I had heard, the only time I'd ever heard this was a throwaway comment in Red Dwarf. I absorbed it. And then I was like, you know, I need a kind of a slang term, you know, that I'm just going to put in. It can't be American because I want it to sound a little foreign and to the English-speaking ear, you know, British slang or British spellings or British expressions sound kind of archaic. And so I threw it in there, never thought about it, went through copy editing, and like 15 years later, I'm like, oh, it refers to a bindi. It's a derogatory term referring to somebody with a bindi. You're a bint. And I'm like, I did not know. Right? So there's no malice. There's no whatever. Like Bast, I like to think actually, you know, Bast would be out there like marching with whatever woman's organization, you know. Bast has a lot going on, but, you know, he is actually very enlightened in terms of a lot of these things. And I feel bad that he ended up accidentally using a racist slur, and that I've actually kind of propagated that through my work. Now, how do I avoid that in the future? It's like, well, I try to have smart friends who I try to have a lot of beta readers, and they're like, you know, I notice you're doing this, and then I look at it real hard, and I listen to them real well and try to avoid it. And some of it, but it tends to be baked in where, the more I watch Clinton, I started with sort of like, well, you know, not my first pick, but it's okay. You know, and it's like, of course, anything's better than Trump. But then the more I've watched her, she is, oh, hell, I'm thinking of the wrong name. She's Ginger Roberts, Ginger Rogers, right? Because everyone's like, oh, look at Fred Astaire. Like, dude is the super dancerist ever. And it's like, but there's Ginger Roberts. She's doing it all in heels and backwards, but she doesn't get the credit. And so I'm watching her, and I'm like, the more I'm aware of my own prejudices and the prejudice of the whole system, and I'm like, for her to be where she is twice the politician of any man in her position. And I'm like, and I've slowly come to realize that. So I suppose that's mine. You tricked me into using mine.
I've still saved
my first one. I still have one left.
I don't want to break my streak of reading long, boring quotes on the podcast to put everyone to sleep. But
Do you have a teaser that you put in, like a little musical stinger for your things?
It's like a test signal tone, so people know to.
Like psychic storm warning. It goes.
Yeah. Here we go. A long, boring quote incoming. But I just had this quick quote I wanted to read that kind of reminded me of this conversation. So this is from a great essay called "The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House" by Audre Lorde. This is warning. This is some real SJW shit that I'm about to read, but I really like it. So this is from Lorde. In a world of possibility for us all, our personal visions help lay the groundwork for political action. The failure of academic feminists to recognize difference as a crucial strength is a failure to reach beyond the first patriarchal lesson. In our world, divide and conquer must become define and empower. Women of today are still being called upon to stretch across the gap of male ignorance and to educate men as to our existence and our needs. And this is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. Now we hear that it's the task of women of color to educate white women in the face of tremendous resistance as to our existence, our differences, our relative roles, and our joint survival. This is a diversion of energies and a tragic repetition of racist patriarchal thought. Racism and homophobia are real conditions in all our lives in this place and time. I urge each one of us here to reach down into that deep place of knowledge inside herself and touch the terror and loathing of any difference that lives there and see whose face it wears.
That's a good quote. You know, of all the instruments that are antithetical to terror and loathing,
I know.
The banjo.
I know. So you're saying about writer's block?
Oh, writer's block. Oh, way to bring it back.
This will all be fixed in editing. I mean,
don't. I like the
organic.
Let's restart. Hi, Max.
Yeah, hang on. Let me get the, here we go. Hey, Pat.
Hey, Max.
We're just talking about writer's block.
I want this all. I want it just raw. I want the whole thing raw in the podcast. You got to promise me, Max. Promise me we'll just do this one. We'll just slap it in there.
Oh, dear God. All right.
Yeah, we going to do it?
No, no deal.
No,
no deal.
No. No
deal.
Everybody help me out with Max.
No,
here.
No.
This is good stuff, right?
You've turned them on me.
I have turned them. Yeah. I will. This is an example of politics and work right here.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
You know,
this is some Jurassic Park shit that's happening to me here. It's like they're turning on us. Why did we put the asexual reproduction lizard DNA in them? What were we thinking?
I didn't do that to you guys. I just so you know. The complimentary water out there has absolutely no asexual reproduction lizard DNA in it. That's not part of NerdCon's charter.
You want to? Well, I have a topic that we could go to. I have a topic I've prepared to call you out on. Yeah, it's more of a call out.
Call me
put you
out
on blast.
On?
That's what the kids say now. They put you on blast. So I'm doing this panel tomorrow.
Put me on Max.
I'm putting you on blast.
No, you can't put me on blast, Max.
Yeah, it's like
I
on fleek,
that,
but bad.
I refuse. That we should have a section in our show where we ourselves use these new terms and in using them, destroy them. Just make them so gross that like no one will ever touch them again.
We're doing it now, I think.
I think. Okay. Yeah, Max, I love the blast. Blast me, Max.
Yeah. Get ready. I'm going to blast you. All right, here we go. So I have a panel tomorrow called The Moral Responsibility of the Storyteller.
Oh, yeah.
Am I on that? No. No, you started this panel last year, and you moderated it, and
yep.
I listened to, and I know because there's a podcast, and I listened to the audio recording, and it was excellent, and so they're re-bringing it back. I think it was a panel that went really well last year, so I'm on sort of like year two of this, and I've been really agonizing over my beliefs on this, because I just agreed to it, because I was like, well, yeah, I could talk about like the moral responsibility of the storyteller, but in terms of my own beliefs, I'm not clear on whether I think storytellers have a moral responsibility.
Really? Whether or not, not what
yeah.
it is?
Yeah. Because last year, everyone agreed that you were just like, well, to start the panel, does everyone agree that storytellers have a moral responsibility? And everyone was like, yeah, of course. And then you went into a really good conversation.
Oh, so what you're really having is oppositional defiant disorder, is what you're telling
me
here.
Yeah, I was like, I can't have all these people agreeing. But honestly, I have some doubts. I'm open to being like persuaded, but I thought we could talk about that. Maybe it would help me put my thoughts together for this panel tomorrow.
Sure. So would you like me to try to persuade you?
Yeah. Yeah. Without sort of rehashing the whole panel last year, I'm curious, why do you just automatically assume that the storyteller, you know, last year, just to remind you, you just told the story about Tolkien had the smoking, and then your boy, you were reading Lord of the Rings, and he was like,
Just to clue these people in, what it was is I said, some people were here for last year, but some people weren't at that panel. My point was, you know, I read The Hobbit to my little boy, and, you know, just like what happened to me when I was a kid, those first couple of chapters, I remember it as being like a real action-packed book, and it is not. It's like, don't get me wrong, I love The Hobbit. I read it to him, he enjoyed it, but like, it is draggy. It is just like really, especially as a children's book. But still, we're reading through it, but what is the cool thing that happens in the early chapters? The only really magical thing is the smoke rings. And Gandalf blows these awesome smoke, even before they get magical, he blows the smoke rings, Bilbo blows smoke rings, then they get together and Gandalf, they're in there and they're telling secrets and it's dark and the dwarves are singing and Gandalf blows these smoke rings Thorin would send out his smoke rings and Gandalf would like shoot smoke rings and pop them. And that's like the first kind of magical thing we see. And so my little boy starts walking around and he has like anything about this long he'll put in his mouth and he walks around and he goes, I'm smoking my smoker. I'm smoking my smoker. I'm smoking my smoker. And eventually we actually got him a corncob pipe just so, you know, he would...
Nip that in the bud.
But I remember thinking, too, it's like, how cool would it be to smoke a pipe when I grow up? Now, I'm not saying that Tolkien was directly responsible for any one person starting to smoke, but when a million people, 10 million people, 100 million people read your work and you put a little bit of the fluence on all of them, and if you smoke, you are more likely to get cancer. The question becomes, how many people has Tolkien killed? And I'm not joking, actually. How many people has Tolkien killed by glamorizing smoking? Not with malice, but definite, there is, I think, a causal relationship there. And I'm not saying he was evil, not saying he was bad. I'm not even saying he was thoughtless, because that was before a lot of the research. But, you know, you can hang that on Tolkien. And a more concrete example is when The Princess and the Frog came out. 50 children were hospitalized because of salmonella, because they'd gone out and licked and like kissed frogs, and then you catch a disease.
Oh,
and you,
that can't be real.
It's real.
That's the razors and the Halloween candy.
Nope.
All over again.
Nope. It's okay. Actually documented, honest-to-God news.
All right.
Yep. Because I would not come to this con.
Isn't that how the kids learn not to lick frogs, though? They get the salmonella.
You're going to have a long row to hoe with that particular... it's for their good in the long run. You could also argue that, like, all those people killed by Tolkien's cancer, their karmic cycle was accelerated, you know, when they're reincarnated after the big C gets them. It's like, well, you know, just sort of speeds them along in the karmic wheel. They reincarnate higher up the ladder sooner. No, I don't think that's fair. So, here's the thing. If you acknowledge that, one, stories have an effect on us. And I think, can we all agree to that? Okay. Actually, I don't even need to go any farther than that. I can go way down this rabbit hole, but if you acknowledge that stories have an effect on people, and we could talk about how deep that effect is, but I would argue, deep, because we're all here at a convention about stories. Like, if I can have an effect on people, then I am responsible for that effect, period. Wow, that's a super simple argument. I don't have to go out of my way to sort of throw that at you. I would actually even say, like, say, if you were a politician having an impact on the cultural dialogue.
This is two.
And as you said, like, you're bothered by the long-term impact of these people on this dialogue, I would say a storyteller is responsible for their impact on the cultural dialogue in exactly the same way. I just nailed that. There's no way he can push back on me now.
So I have a couple of angles of attack here.
Okay, come at me. Blast me, Max. It's gonna get grosser every time I say it. Max, put me on blast.
All right,
Max, put me on blast, Max.
I just want to point out that I'm definitely Hillary in this debate right now. Sorry, that was low. I apologize.
No, it's, and actually, the one of the horrifying things is looking at these two candidates.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Somebody's holding up three. No, this is a joke. It's different because it's a joke. This isn't a comment. No, hold on. You gotta listen to my joke before you decide.
They're clapping. You're getting a Mighty Ducks clap.
He did. That's his. You don't blame me for that. That was his.
As I was saying.
No, I gotta make my joke.
Please proceed, Governor. Please proceed.
Now the timing is all fucked up.
All right.
It's that looking at these two candidates, what's really troubling for me to realize is that if I was a politician, like, I would have to be Trump.
All right. Here's my concern.
No. If you're making me use my one, I'm using it now. It's the fact that in no world could I be as competent as Hillary. It's like, what is making Trump appealing to people, and this is a horrible self-revelatory thing that I've had. You talk about you realize you have some of this in you. My horrifying thing is, like, the reason people like Trump is a lot of the same reason people like me. And that's because I'm good in front of a crowd, and I'm extraordinarily honest about who I am. And those are appealing things. Earnestness is very appealing. Now, the thing is, the me that I show you, I like to feel, is a better me than Trump's me. And though that's that, what that me is very different. But realizing that, wow, Trump is getting along on the same thing that actually makes me kind of popular is one of the grossest feelings I've ever had in my life. So, yeah, actually, that wasn't a joke. That wasn't funny. I thought that that would sound funnier, and now it has just made me double sad inside. Double sad inside should be the name of the podcast.
So with regards to the moral responsibility of the storyteller. So let me start with the first part of this idea of like that the storyteller has all this power over the audience, right? So they're responsible for like the way they give these stories to people. So there's this question in philosophy that I'm really into, and like there's like a sub area of philosophy called philosophy of music, and one of the interesting questions in philosophy of music is where is the music in music? So the obvious, you could start with the obvious, where you could say, well, the composer comes up with the song and writes it down on paper, and that's the music. It's the notes that they write down. So Beethoven writes down the notes, and that's the music. But except that that's not really the music, because if you gave that to two different musicians, they would play it completely differently. So then you could say, well, the music is, it's not how it's written down, it's the performance. It's that the performer takes the music and they play it and the music comes out and that's the music. Except that's not really it either, because 10 different people listening to those performances would hear 10 different things. You know, people from a culture where they didn't have pentatonic scales and the same like chromatic scales that we have, they would hear it very different. They'd have very different emotional tones to the music, right? Some people, it might make them feel one way, some people another. So then you could say, well, so then the music is inside the head of the listener. The music comes into the head of the listener, and the listener, the music is something they do when the data like comes into their ears. But that doesn't work really either, because there's something coming into their head. What's the thing coming into their head now, right? So it's a really tricky, it sounds dumb until you try to pin down where the music is, and then it becomes really difficult. So the view that I like to take is, well, it's sort of a myth to say there is like a place that the music is. That's just like when the Enlightenment philosophers would argue over like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. It's like, well, it's a dumb question, so there's not really any, you know, there's not going to be a number that is the correct number. There is no place that the music is. There's the illusion of the continuity of the music is it's not even a thing. The music is this emergent property of the piece as it's written, the way it's played, your experience as the listener. Somewhere in all of that, this cloud emerges, this thing you can't put your finger on, and that's the music.
You know, it is an interest. I think in text, a lot of times that's referred, like one of those stages, one of those pieces of the discussion is reader response theory. Like, I'm not really, you know, me writing a story down, the story isn't in the text. The story is in your reading of the text. The story doesn't almost exist until you read it. Which there's some truth to that, and there's a little bit of wankery involved in that too. Like most academia, let's just be honest. You know, it's a good question. And I think Theodore Refke, Refke's a great poet, and he said, "O widening gyre, O sidelong glance, who can tell the dancer from the dance?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you sing it, Refke." Where is the dance? You know, and the problem is with a lot of these philosophical discussions, you start here and you go, "So where is it?" And you go, "Ah, it's easy. There." And they're like, "But..." And you're like, "Huh, okay, that's interesting. Well, then maybe..." And they go, "But..." And you're like, "Hmm." And you end up slicing it finer and finer and finer until at some point the discussion becomes quantum. By which I refer to like quantum physics, where you talk to the quantum physics people and you're like, "So what's everything made out of?" And they go, "Oh." And they're like, "Mostly it's made out of nothing." I'm like, "How does it work? How does it all fit together?" And they're like, "Oh."
Yeah, they're sighing because they're geniuses and they're tired of coming up with like dumb metaphors to explain it to simpletons like us who keep asking them and like, "No, explain it easy so I understand it, like, and I can tell my friends it sounds smart."
But what it is like, what they know, what a real, like these people who do this deep science, like the deep magic from before the dawn of time, they do this. Oh, of course you guys are going to get my my Narnia reference. Thank you. There's people that do that, they know, like, the real answer is it like, we don't know. It's like, we've looked really hard at everything and kind of nothing exists, except kind of it rubs against other things, and then there's a vibration, and then it's okay. And so you're like, really, kind of nothing exists, don't ask me about it. And I'm like, but it seems like this table is right here, you know? And that, there's that sort of divide. At some point, the philosophical discussion, the philosophy discussion of that sort, it goes from Socratic questioning, which I love, that's where I live, that's where my heart is, into skepticism, which is like, you can't prove anything, to nihilism, which you can't prove that proving is. You know, and then you get here and you're just like, and like, that is not where you can live. You can't live your life there. You can, but your life sucks. And so I think part of, you know, our job as people who want to live in a world that is other than, is to consciously choose to live in a place where the discussion is worthwhile, and we all acknowledge that, and music exists. And then, like, let's not go so far down the crazy rabbit hole that we elect Trump. Ha ha ha, I've did it anyway. I don't care. Ah.
All right. So that's my first.
I feel bad.
So let me just like follow that train of thought, because this is the argument I was more scared of making, because I might screw it up. But we've threatened on this podcast many times to go and do ancient Greek philosophy.
Oh yes.
Are you guys ready for some ancient Greek philosophy? Yeah, fuck yeah, let's do it. So I love Plato, and my you know, one of the things I think is really contemporary and really interesting about Plato is he's responding to this intellectual crisis in ancient Greece, which is the what he perceives as the intellectual crisis of the Ionian pre-Socratic philosophers. So you guys probably have read about, like, Thales was like the first philosopher in the Western tradition, and what's interesting about Thales is he was the first guy, at least in the Western like written tradition, to come up with a materialist, physicalist, rational explanation of nature. Well, there's sense perception, we see things in nature, but instead of stories or myths, he was like, we can explain these things and go back to first principles, and they behave according to rational rules. That was a very new idea. So he's often called the first philosopher.
Give it to these guys, that's like, hey, Thales, you ask the big question, you go, so why is everything here? And he goes, everything comes from water. Yeah. You water a plant, it grows. You drink water, you live. You stop drinking water, you die. It's like, seems like a pretty tight philosophy. And then other people are like, but... And then philosophy moves forward.
And it's an early form of atomism, too, because he's saying that the base of everything is water. A fun story about Thales is one time he was reading a book and he was so engrossed in it that he walked into a hole. that's written down somewhere, and I love that story. Yeah, so then there's a series of people that come in. Then you have Anaximander, and Anaximander is like, well, it can't be water because water can't create everything, because water can't create fire. So he's like, it's actually more of like fire or phlogistron, which is like the root stuff of fire, is like the material substance. Then you have other people who come along and say other things. Eventually you get to Pythagoras, and Pythagoras says that whole numbers and ratios of whole numbers are the material substance of the world, and that if you look close enough, you'll see numbers, and you'll see numbers and ratios of whole numbers and everything. So Plato comes along, and he's very concerned about this idea of these... he views it as sort of an intellectual crisis that these rationalist, purely physicalist theories have like gripped the intellectual vogue of ancient Greece. And the reason is, you know, when things are explained, what physicalism and rationalism does is it takes the story out of everything. So suddenly the sun moving across the sky is not the golden chariot of Apollo being pulled by the sun god, it's a hot rock, right, in the sky, right? And what Plato says is, well, if the sun is just a hot rock, then what about all of our oaths that we've sworn on the sun? What about all of our commitments? What about our families and our cities and our societies where we've made these promises and these vows and these sacred obligations to each other? Because if the sun is just a hot rock and everything is just numbers or fire or water or whatever it is, and you have that ultra-physicalist view where everything is can purely be explained in material ways, then all of our oaths are just sound. They're just words. And it takes away, he views this as a moral and a political crisis because there's no togetherness. There's no way to get on the same page. There's no way to have a society. And what I'm worried about, I bring this up because, I mean, A, I think it does comment on how important these like stories are to a society. Like in some degree, one reading of that is to say, in Plato's, to say, well, the society is the story, right? If we all tell ourselves the story about the chariot, the golden chariot being pulled across the sky, well, that's the story that we're all on, we can all agree on, and it gives us this place to put our feet on the ground. But another way to take away from it, and the thing that I really deeply take away from Platonism, is this idea of what you want to call a deontological ethics, which means where you decide what's ethical. This comes from Kant much later, but it's the idea of you decide what's ethical not based on the things you think you know. Because, and here's the reason for that, right? If you want to say, well, I'm going to take a moral position in my book on smoking and say that either smoking, given the current knowledge of my time, is either healthy or not healthy, and then that changes, well, I'm an asshole. Because I'm trying to use this, like what you were just describing with physicists, how at the end of the day it's all sort of mystery. We have this illusion of progress and of knowledge, like, well, we've almost solved it, we almost have all the answers, when in fact we're nowhere. I largely agree with that, but then it's like, well, to me, I don't want to decide what is a moral life and what is a moral compass based on these like very tenuous current understanding of facts.
And that makes good sense. Can I adjust that a little bit? Because what you said was, I think, a really important distinction in a lot of discussions, is where you said, well, given this, and then if our understanding changes, you know, because I was trying to do the right thing, but now it turns out X, now I'm an asshole. And you said it kind of glibly, admittedly, but there's a big difference, I think, in my scheme, you know, where we do acknowledge that Tolkien has effectively done harm. Now, maybe not intent, and that's what I want to talk about, is intention. Because morality or ethical behavior, actually, intention is super important. And this is really helpful if you want to have good intellectual discussions with other human beings, is to consider intention as something separate from consequence. And it really can help free you up to have like discussions with people who you do not agree with, and maybe who even hold viewpoints that you find really abhorrent. To what you do is you go to their intention. Because, like, let's say, all the evidence, smoking, pretty bad. And so you write a book that does not glamorize smoking. And then new data comes out, and it turns out if you smoke, you actually get into heaven. You know, and it's like for real heaven, like, you know, which of course is just a library and as much time as you ever wanted to read every book ever written, right?
But then your glasses fall off.
No, that's hell. It's a big cost saving measure, really. There's people with glasses and without, and you just know who's been bad.
It's a weird rule of hell is there's no optometrists go to hell.
Yeah. And so now I sidetracked myself with that joke. The thing is, so let's say that study did happen. Like there's this alternate dimension, infinite library heaven you go to if you've smoked a pipe, you know? And so you're like, oh, Jesus, you know, I've been campaigning against it. Now I'm an asshole. And I would say absolutely not. Because given what you knew, you were doing your best to do good. And all we can do is do the best we can with what we have. And let me ride this through a little bit.
Okay.
Because, like, let's say I'm not going to like point at any one of you and say, like, you, why haven't you given $1 million to charity? Actually, you know, why haven't you given $10 million? It's way worse to not give $10 million to charity than to just not give $1 million to charity. What sort of an asshole are you anyway? You know, it's like nobody would do, because that's insane. Because all you can do is what you can do. And that seems like a pointless statement, but it is the epitome of truth. And once you realize it, it's incredibly freeing, and it's a huge burden, because you realize that you then must be responsible for what you can do.
I think there's like a huge issue with this with regards to the. I mean, I agree with this. Just think it only further complicates the moral obligation of the storyteller. Because I agree with this whole idea, and I want to say, well, really, the written word, these are like artifacts of their time, and you have to understand them in context. And it was really the intention of the author that mattered as to whether they were like sort of behaving morally in writing it or not. I don't know if I even agree with that, but let's just stipulate that I agree with all of that.
Okay.
Well, where does the author get their intentions from? Because we don't agree on what's
moral. It's Jesus. Jesus.
but you see where I'm going with this? I got to do the philosophy thing of, well, that just kicks the can down the road of like, well, then you still have to have some way in your head of deciding, well, what's the moral, what's the moral way to have intentions? And I mean, this is what I mean of like, in philosophy, you talk about the grounding, right? You have to put your feet on the ground somewhere and say, well, I stand here and this is my thing. And you could say utilitarianism and say like, we'll do the most good for the most number of people, but that's not without its problems.
Here's the deal. I know, and so if any of you are ever curious, are you writers out there, and you're like, I don't know where to get my intentions from, you can come talk to me. I am the lever upon which you can move the world, right, to shift philosophers
here. You truly are the Trump Pat, the kids would say it's popping off right now.
I'm going to digress. I actually used to be a member of an organization called Philosophy Club, believe it or not. In my college days, I don't know if that was a sarcastic woo or not. But what is a bunch of kids who were taking philosophy classes in college would get together on Wednesdays at 1 o'clock, and one person would present, and then we would all discuss, and that one person got a grade, and everybody just got pass fail depending on if they showed up. And it was a great, like, it was born on the back of a very charismatic professor, because why else would a bunch of, you know, college kids get together and talk about philosophy? But it was an amazing community. And it was in philosophy clubs that I came up with one of the best philosophic constructs, one of the most useful philosophic concepts ever. How much time do we have left in the podcast, Max? Don't lie to me.
I'd say on this rate, we have about 2 minutes before the audience flees.
No, believe me, you're going to love this. This is the concept of, watch me, I'm going to hook them in for this last 15 minutes that people wanted to go eat at 7 o'clock. They aren't leaving. After they hear about the kick me puppy. Right? Oh, yeah, that's right. See, now you're horrified, but you're going to come along with me just to see where I'm going. Oh, shit, I am the Trump. Oh, this is the worst podcast ever,
I'm,
Max.
I'm watching you set this up, and I'm like, buckle up, folks. Like, here we go. Like,
oh, God. My girlfriend isn't going to want to have dinner with me after this. I'm not going to... Okay, right. Ugh, kick me, puppy. Right. So, you got to take a few things as read here so we can get through this in a timely fashion. But assume that doing harm is bad, right? And we can do that. So here's the construct. Here's the analogy by which we try to crack apart what is ethical or unethical behavior, right? I come home and I'm angry, and there's my dog, and I kick it, right? To make myself feel good. And the dog goes, meow. That's right. And I feel better. And the dog is hurt, and I feel better. And here we're gonna see democracy in action. Who thinks I have committed a unethical action. Hands in the air. Who views this as ethical? Okay. So, now what we do is we alter this scenario until we find the thing that when we move it, the ethics change. So let's say I come home and I'm carrying groceries. I open the door. I'm carrying the groceries. I don't see the dog. And my foot hits the dog. And the dog goes, meow. And I feel bad. Have I been, and I can actually tell, nobody went, oh, or, ugh, right? Have I done, now, and this, they will actually start to see a split, right? Have I committed an unethical act? Who says yes? I have kicked the dog and it is hurt. Okay? We got some people who thinks this is an ethical act. Perhaps ethically neutral? Ethically neutral? Or ethically question mark, right? Fair enough. Now, what if, at this point, usually, if we're having this in a smaller group discussion, some people would say, well, how badly is the dog hurt? Did it just feel bad, or was the dog damaged? Because this is important to them. So, I want to introduce you to the concept of a dog that has been bred specifically to be kicked. It's a kick-me puppy. It has extra durable ribs, right? It's rounded in such a way that the arch of your foot really fits into that puppy, right? But its ribs are like extremely durable. And what's more, Max is like, I am gone. I am not gonna for the rest of the. So, because I'm gonna bring it home. You have this dog, right? And let's say you come home and you know you have. Actually, I'll save that one. You come home and you're angry, and you had a crap day, and there's your dog. And unbeknownst to you, you have purchased a purebred Kick Me Puppy trademark from Rothko Enterprises, right? And the thing is, it's designed to be kicked. Not only is it impervious to kicking damage, when you kick it, it does still make that noise, but it actually, it's just a purely physiological thing. The wind just gets knocked out of it. But when you kick it, it actually feels like the dog is being petted. It fills the dog with joy. You got to come along with me on this hypothetical, okay? Don't sandbag me here. So you come home, you see this dog, and you're like, and you kick the dog, and it goes, nurr! And then you feel good. Now, you don't know, you got this dog at the pound. You don't know it's a kick-me puppy. Have you committed an unethical act? Who says yes? Yeah. And you know why? Because your intention was to hurt. You did not have the effect of hurting, but you had the intention to hurt. And this, now again, what we're doing here is sort of philosophy by commonality agreement, which in some ways is bullshit philosophy, but in other ways is the only genuine and useful philosophy. You can be a deconstructionist if you're a wanker and say words don't really mean, meanings don't mean, nothing exists, blah, frickety blah. But that's garbage because we all talk all day and we all understand what we mean. So, what we just agreed here is that you can engage in the same physical action, walking home, being angry, kicking a dog. The result is totally different, but it's your intention that drives the morality of your action. So, therefore, if you're writing a book and then the data changes, you were doing the best you could, and that means you were engaging in ethical behavior.
Do you think in the history of people writing books, knowing what it takes to write a book, Do you think anyone has ever written a book and not had, I mean, good intentions, not thought that they were doing? So everyone's the hero of their own story, right? Even the people who write the most abhorrent, even like an Ann Coulter book, right? She thinks she's like,
oh,
coming,
that's everyone,
coming
right?
to the
Call
defense
him
of
out.
The Republic. All right. I don't know, but you know what I'm saying? Is like everybody thinks they have good intentions, and then I'm just playing devil's advocate, but I'd be like, what about if you have the best intentions, but you're kicking a dog?
No, and
that sucks. Don't kick a dog.
The thing is, I always thought, well, of course everybody thinks these things because I do, and everyone is like me inside, right? It turns out, no. I've learned recently, just last week, that no, not everyone is like me inside. Because on that panel, and I brought in people who I knew who were good, lively, lively discussers and intelligent folks, and it was Lev on the panel, and he said, "I've never thought about this before," and I went, what? Because like Lev is super smart. He's a book critic. He writes for the Times. He wrote these brilliant books. And he goes, I never really thought about the effect that my books would have on people in that way. Which at first I was kind of horrified, but really not surprised in retrospect because, there's a lot, there's like 1,000 things you have to think about to write a good story, have it be entertaining, and maybe hopefully get it published someday. That's a lot of plates, and none of them are by necessity. Also, will this book make the world a better place? That is not a necessary piece of completing an entertaining piece of fiction. So I wasn't surprised. I was a little, and also not. It's not essential, but I think a lot of people, no more than... I'm trying to think of what other hobbies people do. You make a model railroad and you're like, is my model railroad racist? Will it have a negative effect on the people who experience my model railroad? Most people would never think that. But it might actually, it probably would be really easy for like a Western model railroad if you were going to display it somewhere for it to be like, oh, look, here's the Indians. Oh, there's cowboys. And you're like, well, and you fucked it up. You didn't think that you could have a negative impact on the cultural consciousness, but you did. Sorry. Weren't careful enough. Again, they weren't intending to, but you can have a negative... An unintended consequence, Max.
An unintended consequence. All right, let me throw one more wrench in the works, and this one, I promise this one has a funny ending. It has one of my favorite pieces of research that has ever been conducted by mankind at the end that I can share with everyone. So I read this great book this year. I may have mentioned on the podcast before, but it's called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People like Disagree on Politics and Religion by Jonathan Haidt. He's a psychologist, and he goes into some different frameworks of looking at, like, especially like in contemporary American politics, what is it that, where are people getting these intuitions from? Like, when everyone in this audience raises their hand on the puppy questions, like, why do we all agree on these weird moral hypotheticals? Because in theory, there's no reason that we all should. I mean, these are complicated questions. So he says, in his research, especially liberals in America are almost exclusively motivated by one moral matrix, which is care versus harm. So are you caring for the puppy or are you harming it? And you can make almost every moral decision based on care versus harm. How should we treat this group of people? You care for them. You don't harm them. It's ethical to care for them. It's unethical to harm them. Well, what about this? What about gay marriage? Well, that's not harming anyone, so it's ethically neutral or ethically positive. Because these people care for each other. So that is almost the entire conception of the liberal moral framework. However, he's found that in America, and specifically mostly among conservatives and libertarians, there are actually 6 moral matrices that are all roughly equal to care versus harm and how conservatives make moral decisions. And they're really interesting because they're things I never think about. So conservatives do care about care versus harm. They also care about fairness versus cheating. Is this particular person or a particular group, are they playing fairly or are they cheating? Loyalty versus betrayal. Are you being loyal to your people, your institutions, or are you betraying them? authority versus subversion. Are you obedient or are you subversive? Are you making trouble?
And subversive, of course, is the unethical.
Subversion would be unethical,
wow.
Right? Because you're harming. I mean, I'm already going to a care harm. I can't. I mean, it's something that I'll just say that without trying to condescend, it's something people morally feel very strongly and intuitively is important to them. To the same way that we feel like it's wrong to kick a puppy.
And honestly, I will admit that one. I would not have been able to empathize with before I had a kid.
Right.
Or something like he's running around and I'm like, just stop. Just stop. Why? Just listen to me. You know, it's like authority versus sit down.
You know, there's a whole conservative thing about hitting kids. It's a big deal. Most of this country believes that you should hit your kids, and there's a debate over whether you do it at like 6 months or 6 years or whatever. But the idea is that you hit them because they learn. That's how you learn to be a good, upright, authoritative person. Anyway, I don't want to get bogged down.
Yeah, that's a different
number
podcast,
five. Number five: sanctity versus degradation. Another one. It's hard for me to emotionally get there, but a huge deal. Sanctity, it has to do with feelings of disgust and contamination.
So that's like original in the prequels.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, I guess I can get there. Yeah.
I'm your lowest common denominator,
thank you,
Max.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah. And then number six, the final one, is liberty versus oppression, which is pretty evident. So just a very interesting way of thinking about how people that, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that most of the people here are like pretty liberal and, you're interested in people are interested in like weirdo, like fantasy books and coming to this convention and all of these like, weirdos on panels and me and you. It's like, these are our people. So of course we're going to all agree on this.
But that's vastly interesting to me because you can see that reflected on, the general debate, like, the conservatives coming at
yes.
These debates. I'm keeping this vague, right, so I don't use it up, right? I know. I'm just saying that this is – we can see this reflected in the culture today, can't we? Huh?
Yeah. So here's some. This is the funny thing I promised I would share. It's gonna get real weird. Is everyone okay if we get real weird here?
Let's weird it up.
Let's weird it up. So this guy Jonathan Haidt is sort of famous for doing this research that he called moral dumbfounding. So he takes people and he puts them in like an fMRI machine, which is a machine where you can look at people's brains as they're making decisions, and he asks them moral questions. So you'd start off with a question where it's like. Should you kick a puppy or not? Like the Voigt Kampf test of like the turtle's on its back, you flip it over. So easy questions, right? And you see that people so a couple of interesting things happen. The most important one is first people decide, especially on moral questions, first people decide, then the logic and language parts of their brain activate and come in and explain why they've decided what they've decided.
Right.
That's old research. That's very well documented. We are all guilty of that. We all have a gut feeling, and then the parts of our brains come in and rationalize it. And you have the conscious feeling of it all being one thing where you're just like reasoning it out. But in fact, it's really sloppy and complicated. So he asked people these moral questions where they disgust and repulse people, and their everything in their gut tells them that it is unethical and completely wrong. But in fact, he's leaving no wiggle room on the care harm moral matrix, and liberals become what he calls morally dumbfounded in that they are repulsed, but they can't say why.
They lock up,
and what they do is they'll argue with the hypothetical, and they'll come up with facts that aren't there. And then, in other words, they do everything that like an irrational voter does when you watch the news. You're like, how could people believe this? And this is what? So,
wow.
So let me read. And I fucking love these examples. They're the funniest thing in the world to me. Okay.
Do you want to hit me with them?
Yeah. Here we go. Example A. A woman is cleaning her closet, and she finds her old American flag. She doesn't want the flag anymore, so she cuts it up into pieces and uses the rags to clean her bathroom. Ethical or unethical?
Yeah. Yeah, even like I'm not a big like the flag person, but yeah, that hits me. It feels
wrong.
Yeah, I can't pick neutral.
Yeah, no.
It has to be one or the other.
Yeah. Well, you can.
Oh,
yeah.
It's recycling.
Yeah.
But it took me a while to get there, even for this thing I don't care very much about. Yeah.
So most people, as you can imagine, most Americans would say that that is unethical. But then when you're asked to explain your reasoning, it's actually very hard to find the moral reason why that, in that example, it's so carefully constructed, it's very hard to find the moral example. So people, some examples I remember from this one of people would say, oh, well, what if a veteran is walking by and looks in the window and sees her cleaning with the flag and the veteran feels, they're desperately looking for some harm to have happened to cling on to.
And honestly,
it doesn't exist in the example.
In my head, I was thinking, like, I'm like, oh, you know, a lot of people hang a lot on the flag, and I wouldn't want to take that. I'm like, oh, you know, Grandpa fought in the war, you know? And I'm like, what about Grandpa? But I'm like, what the hell? You know, in my hypothetical, this is, where did Grandpa come from?
All right, here we go. Let's buckle up. It's just going downhill from here. Example B. A family's dog was killed by a car in front of their house. They had heard that dog meat was delicious, so they cut up the dog's body and cooked it and ate it for dinner. Ethical or unethical?
Assuming that they were sensible about how much they cooked the meat, that's totally ethical. And see here, straw poll.
The family cuts up the dog's body, cooks it, and eats it for dinner. Ethical? Raise your hands.
What country are you in?
In America. Unethical? Raise your hands. See, there we go. Oh, look, our little happy liberal consensus is all crumbling. All right, here we go. Example C.
A lot of people are like, but wait, and they're looking to ask questions and get more information, right?
Yeah, go with your...
Oh, if you're starving, it's fine. Nah, that doesn't matter a little bit.
There's nothing in the story that says they're starving. That's what's interesting. I mean, so when people get morally confounded like this, people want to come up with a rationale of well, the dog was diseased, so it's wrong, or well, they were starving, so it's okay. But that's not in the story.
Yep.
Okay. Example C. Here we go. A brother and a sister like to kiss each other on the mouth. When nobody is around, they find a secret hiding place and kiss each other on the mouth. Ethical or unethical?
This one's complicated by the fact that I'm being recorded. I'm fine with that.
What about consensual, non-reproductive sibling incest?
Truth is, I'm fine with it. And see, here, I'm hard to dumbfound. It's like, I have thought a lot about a lot of things.
You're willing to bite some bullets that I'm not here, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, first, do no harm. And two people doing it, it's neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. There's a Thomas Jefferson quote for you. So if you want to kiss your sister, go ahead. Be aware that people
will
look
at you
funny.
That's a good quote for the back of the next book, I think.
Yeah.
All right, final one. A man goes to the supermarket once a week and buys a dead chicken. But before cooking the chicken, he has sexual intercourse with it. Then he thoroughly cooks it and eats it.
Thoroughly sells me on that. You know, get down with your bad self. I'm not here to judge you. You chicken fuckers out there. You can put that on the back of my book, too.
All right. We're not getting any better than that. Let's do a little audience Q&A. So just a couple of quick requests on Q&A. Please ask, because we don't have a ton of time left. Please ask us quick questions and don't advertise anything. I know everyone's got cool projects, but spare us and just get to the question part. And also, no sentences, just something that ends with a question mark.
Oh, yes, it must be a question, not a comment.
Okay. Pat, you see one?
You were so happy there.
The question is, yeah. Oh, Christ. We're going to be here all night. The question is, what are your thoughts on writer's block?
That's a great question. Should we lob that into a future podcast so we can do more live questions here?
Do you have a 2-minute?
I do not. I'm self-aware enough to realize I don't have a 2-minute.
That's
anything.
Why Pat doesn't have writer's block, because he can talk forever.
Yeah. Yeah. I will do that. And the thing is, I also have talked about that before, like in the blog, like on videos. But we can do it for the podcast later. But it will be, that's... It's at least 5 to 8 minutes, which means really it's 10. So.
All right.
What are your thoughts on Terry Pratchett's The question is, what are your thoughts on Terry Pratchett's Hogfather?
Yeah, have you read Terry Pratchett's stuff?
A little bit, just a little bit. I don't know Hogfather.
The Hogfather is an interesting one. I'm assuming you're referring to, you know, it addresses the issue. Who has young kids here? Like here in this room. Smart. Extra points for you not having young kids in here. Anyone
I
with
read
young
all those
kids
examples if I knew there were kids here.
Anyone seriously going once, twice? It addresses the issue of lying to your children about Santa Claus. And I really hope that didn't spoil anything for anyone here. And he's like, is this ethical? You know? And there's this great moment in the book. You really owe it to yourself to read Terry Pratchett in general, that book in particular. It's one of the really good ones. But somebody says, you know, why is it good to lie? Why would you lie? And they said, I think it was death coming in and speaking with some authority, like only death can do. And he says, it is these small lies we tell children that prepare them for the larger lies in their future. He said, if you break apart the universe, I guarantee you will find not one speck, not one atom of liberty or justice. However, this is a lie that it is useful to believe that things like liberty or justice exist. And, you know, it's something that I've struggled with my own boys, because we do Santa, and it's fun, and I love it, and they love it, and I hope they discover the truth and then grow up and engage in this storytelling themselves. But it makes me feel better to have Terry on my side. That's like, I'm not just being a dick for jokes, you know? Yeah.
The question is, who plays the instrumentals on the podcast? And that is my friend Pete Danilchuk, formerly of the band The Bridge Builders. And him and a friend, it's mandolin and fiddle. And they made all these delightful bumps for us. And we were sort of going, he was sort of playing off of our mutual love of Prairie Home Companions. We went a little bit of like country sort of sound, you know, folk music sort of sound to it. And then the way I edit it, the music is often sort of like coming in under Pat and I talking. So I wanted to pick instruments that were out of our vocal register. So Pat's the mandolin, and I'm the fiddle.
Wow, check out the big brain there. If you didn't guess, I don't do the editing. I don't get that. And I'm ashamed for misidentifying mandolin as a banjo earlier.
No, I didn't correct you. Wasn't that big of me?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Max has really won this episode of the podcast.
Thank
this
you.
Debate that we're having up here. Yeah.
Will there be more Trump Overwatch billboards? So this is one of my hobbies. Our company Cards Against Humanity started a super PAC called the Nuisance Committee. Our goal is we raised all this money doing these the Trump and Hillary PACs this year, and we're sort of spending it on a combination of like trying to like talk about issues that we want to bring back into the election, and also but mostly in this phase, like really in this phase of an election, nobody's mind is going to change, unfortunately. So we're sort of out of the persuasion phase and we're into the activation phase. So we're looking at like college towns and swing states. What can we do to get college kids to just remember that there's an election going on? Do something that's funny, that's surprising, that catches their eye, that gets them, you know, in some cases it's the last days to register to vote, in other cases early voting has started. So we're trying to hit those timing sweet spots and just get college students to vote. So we did today, we did this. This is by far this is the dumbest thing that we'll do with the Nuisance Committee, but we did this billboard that says Trump mains Hanzo and complains about team comp and chat. And then it's just a picture
in all chat.
Yeah, in all chat. Yeah, and then it's just a picture of like Trump, like furious, like yelling at a computer screen. And we put it up at Central Florida University in Orlando, and it's making a big stink, and it's right outside the campus, so hopefully kids see it and they're like, oh yeah, I should vote.
And I will say, like, if you don't get that joke, it is hysterical if you play Overwatch, right? That filled me with joy when I saw that.
So we have a couple. So basically, the other piece of strategy. Sorry, I won't dwell on this too long. The other piece of the strategy with nuisance committee is like, it drives me. One of the things that drives me crazy about Trump is that this fucking guy doesn't spend any money on anything, including he doesn't give any money to charity, and you can check out David Fahrenthold's excellent reporting on that. But B, it's like this guy says one crazy thing on Twitter for free, and he gets millions of dollars of earned media of people talking about it, and CNN's like, breaking news, Trump tweeted, we've got the whole panel here to discuss it for an hour. And it's like, this guy, it's like, it's crazy. He's arbitraging the media's insatiable thirst for Trump stories to promote himself, and I feel like that's really unfair, and we should get to do that too. So that's
personally, I'm willing to give him a pass for excellent use of the word arbitraging, Max.
Thank you, Max.
My hat is off to you.
Thank you.
Over there.
So the question was this was a couple months ago at Gen Con. Pat blew into this breakfast place and didn't say hi to me, so I had a dozen hard-boiled eggs sent to his table just to surprise him. And then Pat retaliated by that night when I came back to my hotel room. There were a dozen live chickens in my hotel room.
Baby chicks.
That's,
right?
As we say in international affairs, that's not a proportional response, Pat. So I guess the question was, do we have any other good stories of escalating prank wars or anything?
Not yet, like, although I will admit I was sort of like mid-flinch coming into this. I knew he probably wasn't going to come at me here because he's been way too busy with the election. But I know that there will be more shenanigans, for lack of a better term, in the future.
Oh shit! The question is, will we ever do a streaming thing of the Cards Against Humanity people versus the World Builders people? I can answer this question very quickly for you, which is it'll never happen because we would destroy them and they're cowards.
Now, hold on, Max. Is what you're saying is you're the best at Overwatch? The other team are losers. You're trumping is what I'm saying.
It's not Trumping if it's true.
There's the quote. It's not Trump. That's the title of this podcast. It's totally unfair because they have so many more people in their office, too. And my people, they suck at video games. You know, I'm really... But yeah, we're absolutely going to do that now.
By round of applause, if we had some sort of tournament of cards versus world builders, maybe we get some of our other friends sort of involved. Uh-huh. And, you know, we get some loan shark or people involved in this. And there was some sort of like bracket or betting mechanism. Who would put money on the line for world builders to bet on that tournament? By round of applause.
That's a great... Whoever just asked that question, you've given us a wonderful thing for this year's fundraiser.
We should do this for a living. we're good at this.
Yes.
When are we going to see sleuthing versus blasting?
The question is
sleuthing versus blasting. So this is referring to the sign. Pat and I both have different methods of blasting out our sinuses. I'm a blaster. I like to blast. I have this like squeeze bottle and I blast my sinuses.
No, hold on. We're going to have to put the brake on this because we did actually make people vomit with that podcast. And I saw somebody there who was going like this, and I'm like, so we don't want
It's just a sinus rinse.
Live. This is ethical responsibility of the storyteller, live and in person. I will admit I dropped the ball. I did not. I only just recently got the squeeze thing because I wanted to. I felt a responsibility to try it. The main thing that happened is you freaked me out so bad about the brain amoeba that I stopped using my neti pot. But now I got the special salt that'll kill the brain amoeba.
No, the salt doesn't kill it.
Fuck.
No. The salt, you have to put the salt in so it doesn't sting your nose, because it does something with the pH.
So what kills the brain amoeba?
Pat, you have to boil the water. I told you this. You have to boil... Pat's going to die of a brain amoeba, and I'm going to give a eulogy. I'm going to be like, I fucking told him on the podcast. You have to boil it for like 5 minutes or... But here's
5 minutes?
Wait, but here's what I'm telling you. You can use distilled water, but it has to be a special kind of distilled water through like a special... There's some... I'm telling you, I think distilled is fine. Filtered, there's a special kind of filtered water. But check this out, there's a new blaster that you can get at Walgreens that has the filter built into it. So you can just put the tap water right in and you blast and filter all in one.
Are you putting me on blast, Max?
Yeah.
We're going to kill this fucking word right here.
Yeah.
I want to get sponsorship from Neti Part, and we will just use the word. I'm putting you on blast, and we'll just do that all
the air horns, blah, blah, blah.
Until we destroy that piece of slang, which I hate. Hat.
The question is, Pat, this is a great question. The question, Pat, the question is, Pat talked about his regret over using an accidental racial slur in his book. How do we feel about banning books that have, Huck Finn, that have the N-word in them?
That one is super complicated because as a historical artifact, it's an important book. I would claim that Twain probably, if we want to look at it in the framework we've established, in terms of intentionality, I don't think Twain was intending harm. However, we now are in the position of having this book and bringing it to people as an artifact. Could this book, even though the author didn't intend harm, could we, having the new data we have in passing it along, be doing harm? And honestly, that one is fraught. I legitimately don't know which way I would jump. I would argue in some ways that the damage caused by the exposure to that word in that one book, compared to so many other things that people would be exposed to in the world, that's pretty low. Now, I'm not saying that, like... I don't know. I really seriously don't know where I weigh in on that.
I'm anti-ban, and the reason is purely based on efficacy, which is banning words doesn't work from a practical standpoint. There's a great quote I always think about when it comes to like, well, should we like ban this thing or censor this thing? Which is, you haven't converted a man because you silenced him. I think that's like a Galileo quote.
Yeah.
So I think just from the point of view of like stopping people using language that we don't like, banning it actually doesn't work. But that being said, I have a sort of a weasel way out of this, which is there's a difference between banning a book and not assigning it in the classroom and mandating that kids read it. And for a lot of reasons, I think a lot of like the Western canon is just sort of bad and out of date and not really relevant, and it kind of turns kids off of reading. And there's all these problems with these alleged like classic books that get assigned. So would I say like there should be a movement to like ban Huck Finn from like school libraries? Like, no, it's our history. It should be there. Kids should. If they want to go read it, they should. There's no point in banning it anyway because they'll get it online. But by the same token, like, God, can we stop banning these shitty books? Or can we stop assigning these shitty books in the classroom?
And that's my thought. In terms of banning it, no, I don't think we should ban it. That I can answer very easily. But I immediately went to, it's like, should we be giving it to people? Now, of course, anything taught well is going to be beneficial to whoever you're teaching to. But that's a separate issue because you can't guarantee that it's going to be taught well.
Yeah, but you could teach like a Toni Morrison book well too, right?
It's right.
Like, it's just a stupid argument of like, well, how will kids learn about this issue? And it's like, well, just pick another book about it.
Right. It's like, how can we effectively teach Reefer Madness? You know, it's like, that is, you know, unless you're examining it as propaganda.
You got to have the kids do sick bong rips in the classroom.
Sick bong rips. Max, you are crushing it. You're all the way live, Max.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is a question I would like an answer to as well, which is last year for World Builders, there was a World Builders stretch goal where people gave some ludicrous amount of money that I want to say you selected that stretch goal because you knew you wouldn't raise that much money, and it was like $1.4 million. It was an amount of money that World Builders had never raised anything close to that before, and then you did raise that much money, and the stretch goal was that I come to your house and clean out your home office that I still even haven't even seen because you won't even let me into that room in your house.
Nobody sees that.
Yeah.
It will happen. I've actually been... Yeah, it will happen. I've kind of...
Well, I got my calendar. I mean, let's see here.
November 8th is open for me. The 7th is good.
You know what we could do is, like, I may be in Wisconsin on the 8th anyway doing some, like, canvassing or something.
You're shitting me, really?
No, I don't know. What am I... I'm not going to stay at home.
Here's the thing. During the fundraiser, you know, like, I don't... I am honest about this. Like, I know Max has some stuff going on right now with the election.
Oh, yeah, it's my fault.
And before that, it was me. Like, I was all crazy nuts about Hollywood stuff. But yes, we absolutely do intend to do it. But we want to do it upright. We want it to be good. He wanted to video it. So we don't want to say, yeah, we did it. It was awesome. Here's a couple pictures and a blog.
I'm showing up. When we do this thing, I'm showing up with, like, a construction crew and, like, a construction dumpster. There's going to be, like, people... we're going to be hauling out, like, contractor bags full of stuff. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it will. It'll be awesome.
All right, I think we've got time for one more quick question. Let's do a good one more good question.
If you don't have a good question, put your hand down. Oh, I feel that's.
I appreciate the honesty.
You're my new best friend, but I'm going
to
trust you.
I think the people would like to hear us compliment each other on one thing as the final question. I'll go first. I really admire your children. What a fucking weasel! I don't want to bag on Hillary, but what a fucking weasel answer that was, because Donald Trump's children are garbage. There's nothing admirable about them. They suck.
And there comes the clap again. I'm gonna need to get that on a keychain too. Oh.
All right, let's take a real question.
Okay, yeah, there was the one in the back. I've neglected this side of the room. It looks like furry coat. Yeah.
Ooh, do you have an opinion on Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize?
Yes. Thanks so much for coming.